So welcome everyone to our digitally delayed moon landing class. It was supposed to take place last week and we were forced by circumstance out of my control and your control to postpone till today. So thank you for being patient. This class was supposed to be given in concert with the weekly Torah reading, which was Parshat Bo. But that was like already in the past. But I thought, you know, the book of Exodus is the book of Exodus. We're still kind of just a couple sections in the future from what that story was. And it is very timely and timeless. So why not just give the class? I promised a moon landing. I had a nice little clip art of there. Of you can see the earth in the background. So I thought, hey, you know, I promised you a moon landing, a real moon landing, right? Buzz Aldrin is here. You know, Neil Armstrong, they're letting me know that we're doing this class. So let us begin with a little discussion of the moon, okay? So look at source number one, please. And God made the two great luminaries, the great luminary to rule the day and the lesser luminary to rule the night and the stars. And this is Genesis number 1:16. Interesting. So there's a couple of curious things here that you may or may not have picked up on. So the word luminary in Hebrew is the word me'or. Comes to the word or, aleph, vav, resh, which means light. The me'orot, something that emits light, luminary, right? I guess we use that also colloquially by a person. We say that person is a great luminary in their field, who is like tremendous insight and light in whatever that their vocation might be, right? A luminary. It's good to be called a luminary, yeah? So what is odd about this is that clearly we're talking about two celestial bodies, the sun and the moon, although they're not named, but that's self-evident that that's what the verse contextually is dealing with, the sun and the moon, yeah? But again, we're dealing with Genesis. So the problem with Genesis, and we've touched on this in the past, is that the words in Genesis don't really mean what the words mean other than Genesis. And even in the context of Genesis, the words are sometimes mysterious, unknowable, and therefore there are even questions, as we'll touch on this in a moment, about why are we even going through the process of a 250 to 300 word Genesis creation narrative when the words are not really what they mean. And even if they do mean something that we understand, they're written so succinctly and tersely that they're really not meaningful to us. Yeah? So before we talk about these luminaries and I point out some structural issues with it, I believe it behooves us to talk about the first verse of the Bible. Because again, that introduces us to Genesis, right? In the beginning, Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God creates the heaven and the earth. All right. Now, it's a strange beginning because does he create it in one fell swoop? And then each day of creation, sort of like in a restaurant, all the courses are produced in the kitchen, but then the waiter or waitresses start to bring them out. So you get your soup and your salad, and then you get the next course, the appetizer, and the, right? So maybe that, so it's a debate among the rabbis exactly how to unpackage that. But be that as it may, there's a very, very famous Rashi. Now remember, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi lived in France, and he is the Torah commentator extraordinaire. If you are learning either the Bible, the five books of Moses, or the Talmud, the first commentary and the only commentary that you need to sort of access is Rashi. He was incredibly formidable and prolific. He went through 2,700 pages of Talmud three different times. We don't have the complete third edition. And unfortunately, I guess he didn't hang on to the first two. So one of his grandsons actually finished some of the Talmudic tractates. And when you compare the grandson's efforts with the granddad, Rashi's efforts, it's night and day. It's incredible because what the great Rashi could sum up in four or five or six words, his grandson might take four paragraphs. So it's, you know, there's a mastery here of the succinct, terse directness. Now, the challenge, of course, is if somebody is giving you everything in such a little terse, succinct way, then it takes tremendous scholastic ability to be able to unpackage what he's actually saying. So let's discuss outside of the Rashi, for expedience sake, what he says about that first verse in Genesis. Again, in the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. Bereshit, in the beginning. Yeah? Okay. So what does Rashi say? Lo haya, I happen to know the Rashi by heart, because it's oral tradition, you're allowed to memorize them. Lo haya tzarech, the Torah did not, lahatchil, did not require to mention, to begin at the starting point of Genesis. But rather, Ella, the starting point really, ostensibly, should have been all about the moon and the sun, and or at least the moon and the gift of time. It says Genesis 1 really could not have been a legitimate starting point. And Rashi questions this. What should have been the starting point? And you have it here. We're not going to read it right now. But it's source 3, Exodus 12, 1 and 2. That should have been the starting point for the entire Bible. The story of the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be to you the head of the months. Okay, that should have been the starting point. Well, why, pray tell, then, according to you, Rabbi Shlomo, Rashi, why did we begin the Bible, the Torah, with the Genesis project? Like what's going on? So what is Rashi's real question? His real question is what we just touched on. God, if you're going to give us this mysterious, succinct, unknowable, and literally unintelligible creation narrative, why bother? Why not go to the very first commandment that you, God, are going to give to the Jewish people as a collective, meaning not the individual Jew? So, for example, the first biblical commandment could be bris milah, circumcision. That was given to Abraham specifically, but remember, he wasn't 8 days old, so he had a circumcision age 99. But then his little son, Isaac, he's the first recipient of the 8-day Brit Milah, the circumcision, right? So that was something given to Abraham, but because Abraham is the ultimate patriarch, it was given to us also, that we circumcise our boys. Okay, but at that time, Abraham was not the Jewish people yet. Remember, the Jewish people didn't exist in Abraham's time. The B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, you could not even make an argument that they existed in the time of Abraham. They didn't exist in the time of Isaac. You could make an argument that because Jacob had his name changed to Israel, that the 12 tribes, the sons of Israel, Jacob's 12 sons, you could make the argument that they are the first iteration of the B'nai Israel, of the nation, the children of Israel. But again, it's not so clear because Mount Sinai hasn't happened, the Torah, the Bible hasn't been given. So again, there's lots of nuances that we don't need to touch it on. So what is important here? What was the first commandment in our Bible that was given to an actual nation? The Am Yisrael, the nation of Israel. You know what it was? It's in source 3. The gift of time. That this month, and it's the lunar Jewish month, of what's called Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. If you put the extra S, then it becomes the Japanese car manufacturer. Okay, N-I-S-A-N, Nisan, is the first month of the year. Just as a side point, only in Judaism do we separate out the new year from the beginning of the months of the year. You're probably looking at me saying, well, wait a minute, Rabbi, I was at the temple, I was at synagogue in Rosh Hashanah, which I think means the head of the year, the new year. You're saying that that month, which is actually the seventh month of the year, Tishrei, how can that be the new year? That would be a tantamount to having January 1st, but July 1st is new year. You observe the new year on July 1st, the seventh month of the year. What? Only in Judaism, right? So the order of the months of the year begin with Nisan. So when you start counting the months, the Bible doesn't mention the months by name. That happened later on. They just say in the first month of the year. In the seventh month of the year, on the first day, we blow shofar. On the 10th day of the seventh month of the year is called the Day of Atonement, right? So we don't use the actual names. That happened much later. So, backing up, God gave the Jewish people, while they were slaves in Egypt, not yet Exodus, I'm just using that as a fun word, they weren't out of Dodge yet. They were still technically prisoners to Pharaoh, to Yulbrenner, in Egypt land. He gives them, in advance of the Exodus, their first collective mitzvah, commandment. And what was that command? To consecrate the new moon. Yeah? Okay. Interesting. So Rashi, way back in Genesis, that we just cited, he says, why not just begin the Bible right there? And then you might say, wait a minute, Rabbi.
Right there.
Meaning at the point of Exodus 12. That should be the starting point, because the Jewish people are receiving their first commandment. It's a book of commands. So why not start with number one of 613? Yeah? Why not start right there? Now, it's not a serious question. It's a metaphorical question, sort of to give us insight. But what Rashi is essentially saying is, it's not that we won't talk about the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph. I mean, halavai, God forbid, we wouldn't have like the musical Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. I mean, all the stories of Genesis are the best stories in the Torah, right? They're the most known to us because we learn them as little children and as adults and as later in life, right? So Rashi's not saying, let's just not ever mention Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. He's saying, let's just start with the Jewish people getting the gift of time, the new moon. And then you can kind of have sections where we say, oh, by the way, you know how like in stories you have what's called an origin story where you go backwards? Well, how did, you know, Bruce Wayne become Batman? Well, you have to know that his mom and dad were murdered by some guy outside of right? They have like an origin story, or Superman's planet being destroyed. So we could do an origin story on the Jewish people somewhere in Exodus. We could go backwards and say, oh my gosh, this reminds me of the story with Abraham and I, right? We could still get all those stories, but there wouldn't be ostensibly a book of Genesis. That would all be sort of done. It would be sort of integrated, for lack of a better word, with the story of Exodus going forward. So then what's the answer? Why do we start with Genesis? If we're not really going to give you a Genesis story that is accessible and knowable, what is Rashi's answer? You know what it is? It's all about Israel. You see, the nations of the world, I know we're not going to believe this, you'll be shocked to hear this, okay? The nations of the world are all going to get together and they're going to say, you guys stole the land of Israel. Who would have thought that that would ever happen? Oh, really? Right? The UN would get together? I mean, right? But that's what it's about. That's what Rashi's talking about. He's saying that when the nations of the world critique the Jewish people and say, you have no claim to that land. Now, believe it or not, they're not going to say it belongs to the Palestinian Arabs because they weren't around, guys. But there were people called the Canaanites around that before we had the land of Israel, it was called the land of Canaan, of Canaan. And you know, maybe the Canaanites are going to put up their hand and say, excuse me, God, you stole our land and gave it to the Jews. What permission do you have? And God says, what permission? Really? Oh, open your book, you idiot. It says, in the beginning, I created the heavens and the earth. Guess what, pals? I'm the master of the game. I gave you all first crack. You had Israel. You had Canaan, the promised land. You know what? You're sacrificing your children to a fire god named Molech. You're doing horrific crimes against humanity. So I'm God. I gave it to you first. And then I say, guess what? I'm now going to give it to my chosen people, the Jewish people. Yeah? And that's the end of the story, because by mentioning the Genesis narrative, even in a succinct way, it gives God, if you will, credibility to say, I first gave it to the Canaanites, and then I chose willingly to give it to the Jewish people. End of story. Now, let me ask a question. Would the nations of the world believe this? There was a great diplomat from Israel. If you don't know who he is, you'll go home, you'll look him up. He was one of the most eloquent defenders of Israel in history. His name was Abba Ibn. Have you heard of Abba Ibn? He gave a legendary, really legendary performance at the United Nations, detailing, because he was a biblical scholar of some renown, he was detailing the connection that historically and post 20th century, like post World War I and II, the connection and the ultimate gift that Israel is a Jewish homeland, and there should be a Jewish homeland. And he cited the Bible. He probably cited this Genesis. And you can imagine all the guys at the UN, they're sitting there with their little headphones getting it translated into Russian. And you know what the Russian guys say? Нет, Yet, you know, next we want the Ukraine, right? They're not buying it. Nobody's buying it, right? So what's the purpose of this Rashi? Rashi, are you really out of your mind? You think that the world is going to accept the Genesis number one validates the Jewish claim to Israel? It's been tried. And it's ironic, right? Because the Old Testament, as far as I know, is part of the Christian Bible. So it begins with Genesis. Now, they don't have that Rashi. I understand. The Vulgate and the Septuagint don't have access to that Rashi. Okay? But it's still right there that Abraham was given this land as a promised land to his children. And later on, Jacob gets given this land, right? But the nations of the world, they're not buying it. So you know what, Rashi? You know what it's all about, that first Rashi? Extraordinarily, it's for us. We, as the Jewish people, have to read it. We, as the Jewish people, have to believe it. Because if we don't believe it, we're never going to accept it for ourselves. And tragically today, there are many Jewish people who don't believe it. And you hear about them all the time. They also believe that there's no real biblical, historical, legitimate claim the Jewish people have. So if we don't believe it, how can you try to proselytize, if you will, and get others to buy in if you yourself don't walk the walk? If we're not genuine. So that first Rashi is all about creating and imbuing in us 100% belief that the land of Israel is our manifest destiny. Okay, so let's back up now. So now that we discussed this, and we discussed the connection to Israel, but what about Genesis and the words of Genesis? I think I've mentioned to you before, so please tolerate the repetition if necessary, if you were at the classes. We spoke about how even the words that we think we know what they mean don't mean that. So for example, it says there was water, mayim, above and below. So we all imagine, you know, you turn your tap, and hopefully you've been letting your taps trickle, so you're getting water, please God, and please put those taps on Friday night. Yikes, okay? So we're letting the taps leak a little bit Friday night to protect your frozen pipes, God forbid, chas v'shalom. So when you have water, I know what water is, 100%, but the water of Genesis is somehow it's different. It can't possibly just mean the water that we associate with mayim, the drinking water. It's something else that God used to create our world. What was there? We don't really know what it means necessarily. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. And what about light? Remember the first act of creation? There was darkness, and God said there should be light, and there was light. Well, I know what that means. Or, remember we said luminary, me'or, the word or, aleph, vav, resh, means light. I know what light looks like. Well, you don't. What's the proof? Let me ask you a question. When God said there should be light, what day was that of the creative process? Right up front, yeah? When were the sun, moon, and stars created? Fourth day. The fourth day? Now, we don't even know what a day means, which is delightful, because a day could not possibly mean 24 hours, because it's God days, not human days, yeah? But put that aside, lots of fun here, right? We all thought we knew Genesis, and we're like, what? You're undermining all my knowledge base. I'm sorry for that. So could light mean something else? Of course it does. There is a hidden light called the Or HaGanuz, this sort of mystical, Kabbalistic light that is within the soul of a human being. Maybe that's the light we're talking about, because it can't be sunlight, because in the absence of the sun until day four, whatever light means on day one, it can't mean what we perceive to be light, yeah? Right? So it's a very strange phenomenon. We don't even know what light means. We don't know what water means. We don't even know what a day means. Right? There's a famous story. Please indulge me. A rabbi is having a conversation, maybe on that white phone of Netanyahu, with God. And he says, you know, God, I know you're unknowable, but can you help me out here? Explain a little bit about who you are and what you are. God says, Rabbi, it's beyond your pay grade, but I'll try. He says, $1 trillion, a trillion shekel, a little bit less than $1 trillion, of your money, Rabbi, are to me, God, one penny of my money. So God's thinking, $1 trillion, penny, okay. 1 billion years of human existence is but 1 second of my existence. So God explains this. The rabbi's thinking. He's percolating on this a little bit, like a fine cup of coffee. And then he's a little audacious. So the rabbi says, "Hey, God, can you lend me a penny, please?" God says, "Sure, rabbi. Wait a second, please." Hey! So once again, what's going on in creation? So let's cycle back, if we can, to source number one. God made two great luminaries. The great luminary, i.e. the sun, to rule the day, and the lesser luminary, i.e. the moon, to rule the night. The Eta Kochavim, along with the stars. So do you see something weird that's just not objectively true? The Torah has to be objectively emet, true. We believe Torah emet. Torah of God is truth. So, I don't know about you. A sun is a star, and it's a luminary. The sun gives us light. What about the moon, Landy? The moon is a little slice of cheese, maybe. But say what you want about the moon. The moon is, and our moon specifically, is like inconsequential to any objective reality. I mean, if you want to talk about glorious moons, you got to go to Saturn and Jupiter. Those moons are kind of, at least size-wise, kind of magnificent, yeah? But moons, by definition, are little slabs of rock. They have no light-emitting abilities of their own. The only reason we perceive light coming from the moon is because the sun is reflecting back off like a mirror, and we see the sun's light reflected off of our moon. So to call the sun a luminary, perfect, truthful. To call a moon a luminary? That's not an objective truth, is it? Interesting. So the rabbis have a lot to say about this. Now what I'm going to say is going to sound a little silly, because we're going to be taking this pasuk, this verse, and we're going to be looking at it through the lens of a metaphor. Yeah? Like a parable. So listen to the parable. And please don't judge yet. So once upon a time, apparently, many, many gazillions of years ago, maybe 14 point something billion years of the Big Bang area, right? We don't know. But all those years ago, apparently, at least in the original design that God had the blueprints for, the sun and the moon were of like equal size and luminescence. And the moon kind of looked over at the sun, and the sun kind of looked over at the moon, and the sun said nothing. But the moon was a little miffed. So the moon set a little date with God. You know, he said, "God, I need to have a very serious conversation with you." And he had a conversation. He said, "God, you know, two kings can't wear and share the same crown. Two luminaries, the sun and myself, it's not going to work. It's not going to be pretty. How can you give us dominion over our galaxy? It's not going to work." So God said, "Yeah, you know, you're right. I'm going to diminish you into a little piece of cheese with no luminescent abilities at all. I'm going to diminish your size, take away any light-giving abilities." Now, we have to discuss why God would do this, but again, this is a metaphor. And God did this. Now it's alluded to in source 2. Look, this is Rashi now. So there's got to be a lot of truth here. Okay? Two great luminaries. So what is Rashi answering? See, the beautiful thing about Rashi, he never says what his question is. I just gave you his question. What is bothering Rashi? There are famous books written on each verse. What is bothering Rashi? So you know what's bothering Rashi? My question. The moon is a luminary? That's his question, right? So here's his answer. They were created equal, but the moon was made smaller because it brought charges before God and said, "It is impossible for two kings to use the same crown." So God's response to the moon was, "Diminish yourself." Okay, that's interesting. I don't know what it means exactly. We're going to have to try to come to some understanding, like what's going on. But that is sort of the backstory. So now, is that an objective reality? I don't know. But it's a story that God is trying to impart maybe a message. What is the message?
I don't know. Let me ask you. When somebody becomes self-aware, there's a certain loss of innocence and purity. And sometimes when people ask questions, the response is, well, you know, I was going to let everything be just swimmingly perpetuate itself. But since you have to ask, okay, here's my answer. So perhaps, the fact that the moon became self-aware, remember, the sun was happy. The sun was like, hey, it's okay, I'll share with the moon. That's not a problem, right? But the moon's apparently not into sharing. So the moon was the one that became somehow self-aware, questioned God's creation process, probably not a good thing to question God. And as a result, God diminishes the moon. Now, before you jump ahead of yourself, clearly this is all part of God's plan. In other words, it was never intended for one second that the moon would be a sun. That's not what it's saying. It's just giving us like a backstory to help us understand how the moon could be a luminary and what it could mean. And maybe the backstory is sometimes in life, you know, things are, and a person should accept the blessing they have in life and not question, right? I don't question like why my wife went out on dates with me and got married. If I have questions, I'm just being a little funny, but I would never say, hey, dear, you know, I'm not really deserving. How come you chose me, right? Now, maybe at some point you think, like, why did this happen? You know, and it happens to all of us. Sometimes there's a relationship you have or something going on. You say, you know, you don't say it. You don't articulate it out loud. But sometimes you think about it. We had a situation in my own family where my own son ended up at a yeshiva. And with the whole process of him going to this amazing place to study was put into play by a bunch of other dynamics. And in the end, I was able to realize that both the love of these young men who my son ended up learning with in their same school, their love that they have for us, was a place that my son could then be loved and find a place to home. So originally, they were here for me and for our community to benefit from, which they have. But in retrospect, the fact that my son then was able to go back there and be loved, I realized that it was a reciprocal thing all along. God had a plan. He just didn't tell me the plan until later, right? So that's how life is. Sometimes the mystery of life, the beauty of life, is like as relationships and things unpackage themselves. But maybe it's better sometimes not to be a little too smart. Because sometimes being a little too self-aware can diminish somebody. So the sun was not questioning, whereas the moon was diminished by its own sense of awareness of who it was and didn't want to share. That's a powerful little message. Doesn't really answer the question, though. What's the question at hand? Is the statement, they were two great me'orot, luminaries. That means equal size. Now, I don't have the Google thing here, but I dare say that the size of our little moon compared to the size of our wonderful sun, you cannot in any universe say that they are equal in size and in grandeur. It's impossible. It's impossible. It's not an objective truth. So we need to try to understand how is that true, okay? So what I'm going to share with you now is from my teacher, Rabbi Weinberg. And it is like mind-bending. I hope you find. So hang on to your minds. Okay. What if I told you there is a universe where this statement is true? Because look at the statement. I'll read it again. This is source number one. And God made the two great luminaries. Stop. Two great luminaries. Me'orot. So we now have to somehow understand how that is a true statement. Because it's referring to the moon and the sun. The sun and the moon. And the little backstory that we gave, oh, at one point in Genesis. But what if I told you there's a much more profound answer that will clarify and give us insight into our own uniqueness of our world, of our Torah, of the Bible, and everything that we live for. Okay, ready? So hold on to your hats. There is one place only in the Milky Way and in the entirety of our universe where this statement is an objective reality. If I stand outside just right out here on a clear night, and I look up from the perspective of the planet Earth, from our proximity to the moon and our distance from the sun, this is an absolutely true statement. Think about it. When you look up, the sun and the moon are exactly the same size when you're looking up from Earth. Now, if you leave the planet Earth, it's not an objective truth anymore, because then there's reality of the moon being a little inconsequential, nothing. You look from the Hubble telescope going backwards, you're saying, the moon? The moon just happened to be a little rock in the gravitational, Earth sphere, but it's not consequential in the Milky Way or beyond. Yes, but that's the whole point. The Torah, God's magical Bible, was only given for mankind here on Earth. Specifically, that when we look up from the planet Earth from the perspective of a human being on the terra firma, the sun and the moon are of equal size. Is that an amazing idea? Because think about it. It means that the Torah can only be an objective reality and truth here on Earth, nowhere else. Now you might say, but Rabbi, what if we eventually populate Mars or, Venus? We get good air conditioning, right? What about there? Okay, you could still keep the Torah there. Good luck with the fasting and everything else. But the Torah wasn't meant to be kept anywhere else. The only reality where the Torah is 100% legitimate and true is in its application to human beings on the planet Earth. So therefore, what's even more magnificent is our reality is not shaped by objectivity. It's shaped by our personal human perspective. What I see. And I see the sun and the moon of equal size. It's my reality. It's your reality, yeah? So that means that, for example, I walk out of the Dunkin' Donuts, the kosher Dunkin' Donuts in Queens, where I go for coffee. And there's a man sitting out there, and he looks like a person of need. And I hopefully give him a couple dollars, yeah? What if you told me afterwards, Rabbi, you're a fool. You know that guy, he's out there every day, and he gets picked up by an Uber at the end of the day, and he has a nice home, and he makes a nice living because the Jewish people are very generous, and he knows they're generous, and he takes a couple $100 from you and everyone else, and every day he enjoys. So you know what I would say to you? I don't care. I mean, I might go somewhere else next time I learned that and give another poor person my money, hopefully, right? But did I not get the mitzvah? Of course. Why do I get credit for what I did right? Because the reality is what I see. What did I perceive? A poor person, someone in need. The fact that objectively my money didn't help a poor person, that's not reality. Who cares? It's not germane. What is germane is what I as a human being perceive. If I see a need and I feel the need, that's it. It ends with me. That's it. You hear? It's an amazing idea. In other words, God is teaching us the perspective from planet Earth looking up to the sun and the moon is the only perspective that is defined by you and me as our world, our reality. And that is why, even though the Jewish people, we asked this question at the beginning, we're still prisoners to Yul Brynner in Egypt. But you know what God is saying? You're not prisoners. Because your reality is different. It's going to always be defined by the sun and the moon up there. And your reality is that even though you may feel that you're still locked away in Dodge and Pharaoh still has it over you, you have not yet had Passover yet, but I'm giving you the mitzvah, the commandment of time. You know why? Because time will always be accessible to you. You could be locked away in a prison and have more freedom than Pharaoh himself, as we touched on. Let me share a story. There was a great rabbi, Kleisinger Rebbe, phenomenal spiritual leader who went through hell itself, Auschwitz. And he survived. He recreated his life. And there is a story about him that they were asking about how he survived. And he said, in Auschwitz, there were no mitzvahs, there were no commandments that we could do. I didn't have tefillin. I couldn't put on my tefillin. I couldn't pray to God because it was just, people didn't have prayer books. There was nothing to do. We couldn't have matzah at Passover. Nothing. But there was one mitzvah, one commandment that the Nazis could never take away from us. Once a month, we could leave our barracks and look up at the moon and do a mitzvah called Kiddush Levana, blessing and sanctifying the new moon. That they could never take away from us at Auschwitz. So no matter how we were feeling, we always had one tangible commandment from the Bible that we could access at that time. And that's an amazing idea, because that's what the Jews of Egypt could see. My gosh, we're in hell itself. We've gone through losing so many. Have been murdered by Pharaoh, the infanticide, the horror of the slavery. But we can look up to that moon and see, you're the moon, Jewish people. We are compared to that little moon. And what magically happens to the moon? It goes away. It wanes and wanes, and then it disappears. What always happens after it disappears? It starts to wax, and it waxes back. 15th of each month, it becomes a full moon again. And that is such a comfort to us, that the moon is the Jewish people. No matter where we are and what we are doing, no matter where we are in our world right now, we feel darkness around us. This parsha, we're being taught, just like in Auschwitz, look up at the moon. And you may feel that in America and Europe and parts of the world, it's a lot of anti-Semitism. And lots of things have been taken away from us. Things that we took for granted that would never occur again in our lifetimes, they're happening right now. But if we just take consolation from the little moon lost a lot. But the little moon was never alone. You know why? Because it says, God created the two luminaries, and it says, one to rule the day, the lesser one to rule the night, and the stars. So according to one rabbi, the stars, the Vav, and the stars, is a direct connection to the moon. So as a consolation to the moon losing its size and luminescence, the stars were created so the moon would never be alone. We have stars all over our world that love us. Like our own Senator Fetterman is a star. And those stars are with us, and they are luminaries. And in our darkness, we should look up at the sky at night. We'll see the little moon, and that's us. And we know that we're waning, but that we're going to wax again, 100%. And while we're waiting to wax, we have the stars to make us feel consolation during the difficult times. Thank you, everyone.